Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 21st, 2024, we're delighted to host a litigation update on matters related to the First Amendment in the classroom. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I'll keep my introduction of our guest today brief. But if you'd like to know more about any of our speakers, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Miles Coleman, who is a partner at Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough LLP, where he practices in the areas of appellate law, business litigation, and First Amendment law. In addition to representing clients in complex civil and criminal litigation and appeals, Miles advises and represents public and private universities and serves outside general counsel to several businesses and education clients. He also represents and counsels private entities and government agencies and officials, including multiple current and former governors of South Carolina and members of Congress, on issues related to constitutional and statutory freedoms of speech, religion, and association. His First Amendment work has been cited by the United States Supreme Court. Also joining us today is Kayla Toney, who is an associate counsel at First Liberty Institute, where she concentrates on religious liberty matters and First Amendment rights for clients of all faiths. Prior to joining First Liberty, Kayla litigated religious freedom cases as a constitutional law fellow at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. She clerked for Judge Gregory Muggs of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces and worked as a litigation associate for the D.C. office of Winston & Strawn LLP. Finally, joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Professor Eugene Bollock, who is the Gary T. Schwartz Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law, where he teaches First Amendment law and is involved with the First Amendment Amicus Brief Clinic. Additionally, he has often taught criminal law, copyright tort law, and a seminar on firearms regulation policy. Before coming to UCLA, Eugene clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the U.S. Supreme Court and for Judge Alice Kaczynski of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He is an author of multiple textbooks, as well as over 90 law review articles. In addition to his academic work, he has filed briefs in more than 125 appellate cases throughout the country since 2013. And I will leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them via the question and answer feature that's found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Eugene, the floor is yours.
So thanks very much for putting on this webinar. It's a very interesting subject, and I think we're gonna turn to Miles right now, and he'll talk a bit about his thoughts on the matter, then Kayla, and then we'll have a conversation.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks very much. So just in terms of to flesh out the roadmap, I've got a case update that I'll start out with. Kayla's got a case update as well. And then we're going to bounce back to me. And then I want to talk a little bit about a regulation that has recently been adopted in South Carolina that's germane to this topic. But let me start with my case update. Got a case pending in district court, the District of South Carolina. I'm going to give you a high-level summary of the facts, and then a little bit of the update. And then there's actually a couple of points that I think are pretty interesting doctrinally. Kayla and Eugene, I know both of you all are First Amendment nerds. I say that affectionately, for I am one of you. And I suspect that many of our attendees today are First Amendment nerds as well. And so I want to pick up on a couple of points that I think are interesting and underdeveloped in the case law, which is not terribly extensive in this context. Let me start with a high-level overview of the case. So Pickens County is a county in the upper part of South Carolina, the upstate of South Carolina, up towards the direction of the Blue Ridge Mountains. There is a unified school district, public school district, within the county, the Pickens County School District. Like most public school districts, it's overseen by a board of elected trustees, the school board, who has sort of the ultimate authority over the operations of the district. As has been increasingly the case across the state and across the nation, parents are, I think, becoming more aware of and involved in the materials that are being used in the classroom and in the public school library. I say aware of because I think there is an increasing acknowledgement of the fact that there are materials that some find objectionable for one reason or another, and involved in that there's been an increasing number of challenges, again, across the nation. In this case, the one pending in South Carolina, some parents challenged the inclusion of the book Stamped. This is a young adult version of the what was previously an adult version, a very popular book by Ibram Kendi. It's a book about racism, anti-racism, and contemporary society. Now, when it talks about contemporary society, it does that through a historic lens. The book says right up front, this isn't a history book, it's a present book. It's not really about the history, it's about the present. But nevertheless, it spent several hundred pages going through an account, I will say, a perspective of the history. And that's really where the rub comes. There are a number of instances throughout the book where the historic recitation is of, shall we say, dubious veracity. Professor David Bernstein from George Mason has written on this, as have others. In late 2022, I believe it was, some parents who had students in the district challenged the use of that book in the classroom and in the libraries of some of the high schools within the district. It went through their internal process of being reviewed by committees, and ultimately got to the Board of Trustees, the school board, who voted to remove it from the classroom, where it had been an optional supplemental text. And to make it available in high school libraries only with parental permission. There's not a terribly extensive factual record from the deliberations of the board, but what there is, again, from the recorded board meetings, again, expressed concerns with the historic accuracy and the authenticity, the errors, both errors of commission and omission throughout the book, and its lack of academic rigor. Now, how did that turn into a lawsuit? Well, around that time, people who were not on the board were talking a lot about the book and about this proceeding on social media. Many of those perspectives admittedly were political or viewpoint-based. They disagreed with viewpoints expressed in the book as opposed to its academic rigor and objectivity. So you got these third-party outside voices making a lot of noise about the book, being ideologically wrong or the disagreements with the viewpoints in it. The board never expressed those sentiments. In fact, in the litigation, have made clear that that wasn't their basis. But in any event, they removed the book from the classroom and put it in a library subject to parental permission. Subsequently, six parents, three married couples, six parents who had students in the district, and the Pickens County chapter of the NAACP sued the school district, alleging a First Amendment violation. Again, that's sort of the high level overview of the facts of the case. Where are we now? What's sort of the update is that the plaintiffs moved for a preliminary injunction. District judge denied it, claiming they hadn't proven the four-factor test that they would need to. Plaintiffs subsequently appealed that to the Fourth Circuit. Now, here's where it gets a little funny. The district judge, in denying the preliminary injunction, ruled from the bench. It was a fairly extensive oral ruling. In the transcript, it occupies a couple of pages. It went up on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. Plaintiffs then moved for a summary vacatur to send it back down for a more exhaustive findings and conclusions to explain the ruling. So that's where we are back down. Now, here's what's interesting. Here's kind of the most recent interesting development. Is the district court judge, because some time has elapsed now, right? From the time the case was filed, now in late February, it's probably been 9 months since the case was filed. Judge asked for a factual update of whether anything interesting and notable to the preliminary injunction analysis has happened. The plaintiffs filed their update and alleged that a number of students have sought to check the book out from the library and were unable to do so. Well, we did a little bit of investigating, and as it turns out, in the 9 months that this matter has been pending, four students have sought to check the book out. One was immediately given the parental permission slip to take home and get signed. The other three were all three children of the plaintiffs who went to the library to ask about the book on the day that plaintiff's supplemental memo was due. In one instance, they asked a 14-year-old high school librarian helper where the book was, and the student didn't know and couldn't find it. And all of them have since that time been given the opportunity to check the book out, and two of them weren't actually interested in reading it anyway. One got the book and checked it out ahead of time. So that's kind of what the case is about and where it's at. So we're still awaiting a more extensive ruling on the preliminary injunction. Meanwhile, there's a motion to dismiss pending. All of that say, I do want to get to what I think are three pretty interesting points. And Eugene or Kayla, feel free to jump in response or comment on any of these. But there are three things that I've seen illustrated in this case, and frankly, that I think are reflected in a number of the pleadings and allegations in similar type cases that I think are frankly just incorrect from a First Amendment doctrinal standpoint, and that I think are really important. But again, both in this case, which I'm involved in, but more broadly and within the academy to understand. And the three things are this. First, often, I hesitate to say always, but very, very often, these cases are framed up as if the dispositive factor is the school board's motivation, right? They're framed up as if we can prove viewpoint discrimination, then this is necessarily and inescapably a First Amendment violation. Boards can't discriminate in their content selection, curation, and removal on the basis of content or viewpoint. And I'm explaining why I think that's wrong in a second. So that's number one, where I think these are framed up incorrectly or inaccurately a lot of times. Second, you'll see them framed up as if the controlling standard is found in cases that talk about student speech. Right, so you'll see citations to Tinker versus Des Moines, right? Sort of the famous Vietnam era case. You'll see citations to the Bong Hits for Jesus case, which is a more recent one. And the assumption, or sometimes expressly stated, is that the standards in those cases, let's say Tinker, for example, is this going to cause a substantial disruption to the academic and learning environment? That's a standard that should control here. And I think that's wrong as well, which I'll mention in a second. The third and final thing I'll mention at this point, you'll see these often teed up on either the assumption or the express assertion that students have a constitutional right to have access in school, to certain ideas or topics or exposure to things that they think they should or that they want to. I think that's incorrect as well. I don't want to eat up too much more time because I could talk about this for a long time and Kayla would never get a chance to talk about her case. But let me just kind of touch on those briefly. And then again, Kayla or Eugene, if you guys want to jump in with thoughts or questions, you can as well. I think each of those three things is a symptom of the same underlying error. And that underlying error is a failure to recognize that what we're talking about here is government speech. We're talking about a public school, which is the government, right? Using public funds to purchase books that will be owned by a public school, the government, housed in a public building and used to administer a government program. And if you have spent much time at all in First Amendment worlds, you know, there's a big difference between government speech and the set of rules that and precedent that apply there versus private speech and the rules and precedent that apply there. Again, I'm gonna try to land this plane, at least on this part of it. So how does that affect the three errors that I mentioned earlier? So first, there's this assumption, or even sometimes express statement, that if the plaintiff can prove content or viewpoint discriminatory motivation, that means they should win. I don't think that's true at all, right? Because if the government is the one selecting the message and conveying the message and paying for the message, then I think they can. I think there's plenty of precedent. I shouldn't say plenty. There is precedent. I think there's enough precedent, although it's not the most robustly developed body of case law, but there's precedent to say the government not only can, but to some extent must. It's inescapable that it will determine the content and the viewpoint of the message that it is going to convey. So I think that undermines that first erroneous assumption. Second was the one where there's an assumption or an express assertion that these cases should be controlled by Tinker or by the Bong Hits for Jesus case or other student speech cases. But again, those are involving student speech, private speech, which is a different thing entirely than government speech, right? That applies to the employment context, right? Think of Garcetti versus Sabalos. It applies to funding issues, right? You think of Russ v. Sullivan with the AOC case, some others like that. So again, I think that's a pretty significant distinction. Third one, the third error was the idea that students, the assumption that students have a constitutional right, that was my power cord falling down very noisily there, a constitutional right to hear or be exposed to ideas that they want to be exposed to. I just don't think that's true. I don't think there's case law to support that. You can find examples of individuals in very particular and very controlled environments, let's say like a maximum security prison, who have a constitutional right to get access to materials, particularly religious materials, but not exclusively, that they may have a right to get access to. We could think of deployed soldiers overseas, where they're in a very particular and unique context, where some of the normal constitutional rules, let's say the Establishment Clause, applies differently, right? The Army can pay and hire a chaplain because those soldiers do have a constitutional right to access to support and services along those lines. But I don't think there's cases to support this idea that students have a constitutional right to force the government to convey to them, the students, the message that the students want to receive. And I think once you realize that it's government speech we're talking about, that's a pretty significant and even dispositive distinction. All right, I've spoken for about 2 minutes past what I was hoping to, so I'm going to stop. I don't know if y'all want to jump in with any comments or questions. And if not, then I think Kayla, you're up next to talk about your Minnesota case.
Great, Kayla.
All right, well, thank you so much for having me on today. I'm excited because there's some interesting connections and overlap between our two cases, even though they're different issues in different states. So I am an attorney at First Liberty. We represent clients of all faiths free of charge on religious liberty and First Amendment issues. And we just successfully resolved, we believe, a case in Minnesota. We represent six families who are members of the Somali Muslim community in St. Louis Park, which is right outside the Twin Cities. And several of these moms first reached out for legal help back in October of last year when their third and fourth grade students came home and told them about some books they had read in English class. One was called Our Subway Baby. This is about two gay parents who adopt a baby, and the book really celebrates their relationship and calls them the family. One was called Ho'onani Hula Warrior, which is about a young child who wants to change genders and is celebrated for that reason. And the third was My Shadow is Pink, which is about a little boy who wants to wear dresses, and his father is initially concerned and then decides to embrace and affirm that. And soon the father is also wearing dresses and encouraging the boy to wear dresses as well. So these were the books that our clients knew about because their children told them. And as sincere Muslims, our clients had very serious concerns about this, partly that they weren't notified before this curriculum was put in place. This was a new kindergarten through fifth grade curriculum that was installed across the school districts without any notice to parents or opportunity for them to weigh in on what the materials were. And then also because, you know, these are very young children and the parents feel, according to their sincere religious beliefs, that it's important for them to decide when their children are ready to encounter beliefs that are very different from what they're learning at home. Our friends at the Religious Freedom Institute connected these clients with us at First Liberty, and we've had a great partnership with True North Legal, which is a Minnesota-based law firm as well. And they have helped us in particular with Minnesota's opt-out law. So Minnesota has a very strong, very simple opt-out law that states that parents have a right to review the curriculum that their children are learning. And then if there's anything that concerns them, they can request alternative learning. And it's very broad. It doesn't refer to sexual education or any particular topic, but it's very helpful in this case. And so is the First Amendment, it turns out. So just jumping back to October real quick, soon after our clients found out about these books, they spoke at a school board meeting. And three different Somali mothers shared very respectfully about their faith and their concerns and said, you know, all we're asking is to opt our children out of these books. We're not asking to change the curriculum. We don't discriminate. We have no problem with our gay and lesbian neighbors. We just have this religious concern. And one of the school board members, who happens to be a lesbian, shared that she was very concerned as a member of the queer community that the Muslim community was not showing solidarity, because that's what she expected from them. And she said, you know, the queer community, we're not going anywhere, implying to these immigrant parents that they should probably go somewhere, and really just shut down discussion, refused to engage, stormed out of the meeting. And our clients, as you can understand, felt very attacked by the hostility that they experienced at that board meeting. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it. It's wild. But soon after, they retained us, and we sent a demand letter explaining to the school district the free exercise problems with their position. At this point, all the clients had requested opt-outs in writing, and the school district refused. They gave a few reasons for their refusal. They said that too many parents would request opt-outs, and it would be too difficult to accommodate all the requests. They said this material was part of the curriculum, and so they weren't able to provide an opt-out. And they also said that because the children have friends with LGBT parents, every child needed to be seen, every family needed to be represented, and so these children needed to be exposed to families that looked different from their own. So in our demand letter on November 2nd, we explained the free exercise problems. And really what it comes down to here is the right that the Supreme Court recognized in Wisconsin v. Yoder, that parents have a duty and an obligation to raise their children in accordance with their sincerely held religious beliefs. That's really at the core of free exercise, because what is your religious liberty worth if you can't pass it on to your child in the way that you see best? And so that's really the right that's at the core here. It's free exercise and parental rights together. And it's powerful. And an opt-out is a perfect example of a way to have, in a pluralistic society, a very workable solution. Religious parents are not dictating the content of the classroom. They're not changing the curriculum for everyone else. They're simply choosing to have that religious exemption. And I think other examples we see throughout American history, you know, conscientious objectors who aren't able to fight in a war because of their conscience. Obviously, war is, you know, an important interest for the country, but we have long recognized that conscience is so important as well, that we can make room for exemptions and those people can serve the country in other ways without needing to, you know, partake in violence that would violate their faith. A more recent, more controversial example, obviously, would be the COVID vaccine exemptions, where, you know, the vast majority of people maybe received this vaccine, but some people had sincere religious concerns about it. And were able to opt out or to, you know, receive exemptions. So this is just kind of another example of what that can look like. And then together, between the First Amendment concerns and Minnesota's opt-out law, which makes very clear that parents have this right to review curriculum and then request alternative learning, we felt that it made it, you know, a pretty open and shut case. It turns out the school district did as well. 3 weeks later, after our demand letter, they created a new alternative learning procedure. And they posted it on their website for the first time in English, Somali, and Spanish. They sent out a newsletter to all the parents letting them know about this new procedure. And we were encouraged. We thought, okay, this is a step in the right direction. Our clients were excited that now, for the first time, because of their willingness to stand up and ask for this right for their children, there was this procedure. Now, we did send another letter to the district in early December explaining that this was a step in the right direction, but that we still had some concerns. And again, this goes back to the free exercise clause. The case law is very clear that government officials should not be deciding which religious beliefs are worthy of solicitude. That's in Ocentro versus Espiritu. That's also in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. And our concern with this alternative learning procedure that the school created was that it was very detailed. It was a 6-page long form and asked the parents to describe their religious beliefs in detail. They had to affirm that they had read the book, that they had read reviews of it and analyzed it. And then they had to say what they thought was good about the book and then what they thought was, you know, potentially bad. And this was just beyond the scope of what, you know, especially parents who English is not their first language. This was very complex. This was intimidating to them. They felt that they needed a lawyer to navigate it, which, you know, did not make it a workable solution. So we explained all that to the school district. And then at the same time, we did fill out at least part of these forms for our clients in a way that was not invasive. We just simply said, you know, because of their Muslim religious beliefs, we're asking for this opt out. And we only knew at that point about three books that our clients were concerned about, but there could be many more. Our clients had asked for a chance to review the curriculum and the school had not cooperated with that request. And so we also asked for sort of a broad opt out from any teaching, homework, discussion, assemblies that have to do with LGBTQ sexuality, figuring that would sort of cover our clients' concern for the opt out. And lo and behold, within a few weeks, all six of our clients received verbal and written assurances from the school district that their opt out requests were granted. So we were a bit surprised. We were fully prepared to go to court, and we still are if any of these reverse course. But the elementary schools, in addition to the middle and high schools in this school district, all agreed to provide these opt-outs, not just for the three books that we flagged, but for, you know, any topic relating to LGBT. And the middle school went so far as to agree to provide the parents advance notice when these topics are going to come. And that's really our understanding of what Minnesota's opt-out law requires, and also what the free exercise law requires, because for parents to have a meaningful opportunity to opt out, they need to know when the teaching is coming, have a chance to review it, decide for their own family whether their child is developmentally ready to encounter those topics or whether it's going to violate their faith, and then choose that opt-out. So that's where we are now. We see it as a great win for not just our clients, but for any parent in the district, because now there is this procedure where any parent, for any reason, religious or otherwise, can request an opt-out from teaching that, you know, they have concerns about for religious reasons or other. And so we really see that as a win for parents in this school district. And our hope and expectation is that other school districts will follow suit, whether for good reasons or, you know, just to avoid lawsuits. Our hope is that they will continue to provide alternative learning, to provide this opportunity for parents to really exercise their free exercise of religion, to exercise their parental rights, and to have that input into what their children are learning in school. So I'll pause there, but happy to discuss or answer questions.
Great. Thanks very much. Miles, I know that you have some more things to say about that and on the library question. But before we get to that, just to break things up a bit, to ask Kayla the question. So I looked up the Minnesota statute. It is 120B.20, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it does look really quite broad. It's not limited to religious opt-outs. It's not limited to opt-outs from matters related to sexual identity or sexuality or what have you. It really applies to any topic for any student under age 18. Now, your free exercise argument, I think, would be limited to people who have religious objections, but would likewise apply to a wide range of topics. So look, Minnesota legislature chose to do this, and so far it seems the skies haven't fallen, but it makes me wonder. I mean, let's say you're teaching biology and some people want to opt out of the unit on evolution. All right, but there's going to be an exam at the end, and presumably the teacher ought to be able to test students on that. But what if they don't just want to opt out of one little unit? Let's say, for example, there is a history class, and some students say, some parents say, we just don't approve of the way you teach the Civil War, or even, let's say, American economic history. So we're going to listen to the Revolutionary War stuff. We're going to listen to Vietnam War stuff. But for the other things, we're going to send the kids off to a different class session. So it turns out that, you know, they're there for a third of the class, let's say. And again, there's got to be an exam at the end. Would the teacher have to give a different exam, or like only grade those questions that don't mention that material? I mean, it's easy enough when you're talking about kindergarten. It's not much by way of exams, but this statute, and again, the logic of your argument applies to a vast range of things. It seems a strange way to run a school system. It's one thing to say you're entitled to just send your kid to private school, of course, if you can afford it. But it's another thing to say you can pick and choose in any class any portion of material that you disapprove of, and again, under the statute, for any reason, all that requires is an objection to the content. You may just disapprove it because you just think it's factually inaccurate, or you think it's slanted or whatever else. How's that actually going to work?
Those are all great questions, and I appreciate you raising them. I think it's important to distinguish here between doctrinal questions and workability questions. And I think what you're pressing on is the workability. So, you know, let's say I'm a teacher.
Is actually a good idea?
Okay. So I guess it's both. I would say the statute has been on the books for more than 30 years. The sky has not fallen. It's only been tested in court once or twice. And so in large part, it has not been controversial. It's largely been used for traditional opt-outs from sexual health and education, which currently 35 states have laws allowing opt-outs from sexual health and education. So this one is very similar. It just does have that broader element. But I think when it comes to workability, the point of the statute is that the burden is on the school to make sure that parents are being heard, to make sure that they know what their children are learning in school, or at least that they can request access to that. And then that last line of the statute says school personnel may not impose an academic or other penalty upon a student merely for arranging alternative instruction under this section. School personnel may evaluate and assess the quality of the student's work. So let's say the student gets a different book to read instead, and they don't read it, and they slough off, and they don't do their book report. Then they can certainly get a bad grade for that. And the teachers are, you know, well within their educational teaching, but the school can't, you know, punish a student just because their parents selected this alternate learning. So I think that gets to workability, and that's where, you know, it is supposed to be kind of a locally controlled issue where the school board and the parents can work together to find a good solution. But the reality is here, I mean, this has been on the books, the sky has not fallen. And because opt-outs don't change the curriculum for anyone else, that to me seems like sort of the hinge point. If parents were trying to, you know, get evolution out of the schools altogether, or get, you know, certain topics to not be even introduced, that's where, you know, great, have parents on the curriculum committee, let there be that input, that back and forth. Parents can vote for school board members that reflect their values. That's what school boards and democracy are supposed to be all about. But here, you know, it's again just that classic religious exemption of, you know, choosing to opt your child out. And I think also to the workability point, children leave class all the time for various reasons, doctor's appointments, English as a second language, tutoring, music lessons, standardized testing. Those are, you know, just a few examples in this district that we found where the school is very flexible, bends over backwards to accommodate the requests of the parents, the needs of the family. And so our understanding in this school district was the fact that they were denying the religious parents opt-outs for religious reasons, but they were allowing all sorts of other accommodations for everyone else. That really showed some underlying hostility toward the religious beliefs. And even now, even after we've, you know, ostensibly won, the school district is still saying, you know, they're committed to their diverse and inclusive curriculum. They don't like the idea of opt-outs based on protected classes, but they're sort of required to do it by under state law. And that's kind of the rhetoric that we've gotten from them.
Focusing on the other example, Gabe, like if my child had a doctor's appointment, the teacher, of course, would let him out of the class, but he wouldn't let him out of the reading. And he'd probably say, you know, some of what was covered in class may end up being in the exam, so you'd better do your reading, right? So it seems a little different than an entitlement to opt out of even doing the reading.
That's a fair point, sure. And so maybe a better comparator here would be English as a second language. Families get to decide whether they want their child to participate in English as a second language. And, you know, some immigrant families don't because they feel that their children know English very well and they don't want their children to be singled out or treated differently simply because they might be a second generation Americans. And so so that's an example where if a student's in English as a second language, they probably will have a different test on their English reading than a student who's in sort of the traditional class. And that's fine. That's workable.
Got it. So we have a bunch of questions in the Q&A. So Miles, can I ask you maybe to talk 5-7 minutes about speaking of workability, about this South Carolina proposed regulation that would decide how books are to be removed? Your argument, which I think there's a lot to it, is that it should be up to the discretion of
the government to decide what's going to be in the government-run curriculum and what's going to be in the government-run school libraries, which makes perfect sense. But then the question is how that discretion should be sensibly exercised. So tell us a little bit about that regulation.
Sure, absolutely. And the hardest part about that is going to be 5 minutes, but I'll do my best. So zooming back out in South Carolina, zoom back out to a statewide level, there have, right, not just this one book in Pickens County that we talked about, there have been on a statewide level many books in many districts challenged, in some instances, many of them all at one fell swoop. So what you've got is a patchwork quilt, both of processes and of outcomes. There's more than 80 different specific, individual, discrete public school districts in the state. Many of them have their own internal district policy for how they're going to make these decisions. They are not all the same as one another. And the way they execute them and the outcomes they reach are not the same as one another. So part of the goal from the State Department of Education standpoint was to bring some clarity and uniformity of standard and process to the process. So the State Board of Education, which is a component of the State Department of Education, has over the past couple of months been in the process of regulatory rulemaking. They've gone through a notice and rulemaking process that has just concluded at the regulatory stage to create a new state regulation regarding instructional materials that would include both curricula, library materials, and other books or other materials housed in and used by public school districts. From a procedural standpoint, the State Board of Education has now adopted the regulation, but it's still subject to approval or disapproval by the General Assembly, which is our state legislature. That will happen at some point in the next couple of months. So it isn't in effect yet, but it has been adopted. So let me get back to your question about workability. I think there's a couple things about this regulation, which I was retained to advise the State Board on its legality and defensibility. I think there's a couple of things that are interesting about it and that go to that question. I'll leave to the side all of the process-oriented timelines and the form that you challenge, use to challenge a book and that sort of thing. Because that, frankly, that's not quite as interesting to us doctrinally. That's just mechanical. From a workability standpoint, here's, I think, a critical component of the regulation. It sets what's essentially kind of two circuit breaker switches right up at the very top of the decision tree. And I know I just mixed an electrical metaphor with a decision tree metaphor, so I'm sorry. The two at the top of the at the top of the decision tree are that material, in order for any material to be used in a K-12 public school in the state, it has to be one, age and developmentally appropriate as defined by the reg, which we'll talk about in a second, and two, aligned with and supportive of the state instructional standard, which is an extensive set describing the academic objectives of the public school educational program. So you've got to pass those two initial hurdles in order to get into the building. Of the hundreds of thousands of books and other materials that can easily pass those two hurdles and make it into the buildings, the reg then gives a five-part, what we might think of as a prudential set of factors that school boards can use to guide their analysis. Just like in the context of standing in court, right? There's constitutional standing, there's prudential factors. Here we've got these two circuit breaker switches, but then once you get past that, there's some prudential factors like how academically rigorous is the material? How objective and suitable is it? Very practical considerations like how much shelf space do you have in your library, right? Like there's a finite amount of book space. There's a finite amount of teaching hours in the day. And at some point, teachers, administrators, and boards may have to make the decision. In order to put something new in, we've got to take something old out. So we've got some prudential factors there. Let me drill down though, because here I think it's kind of where the rubber meets the road, workability-wise, on that age and developmentally appropriate piece of it, right? That's one of the two circuit breakers or one of the two kill switches at the beginning. The way that's defined in the reg is actually fairly narrow, I would say, though we'll probably talk about that and we can debate how narrow it is. I say narrow as compared to what we've seen in some other states or what we've seen at a district by district level. Material is, we'll define it negatively. Material is not age, and developmentally appropriate if it includes descriptions or depictions of sexual conduct as defined by, and then it cites to a specific section of the South Carolina Code, 16-15-305C, for those of you keeping track of them. So right off the bat, you can see what's the primary target, if we want to call it that, what is primarily going to be excluded by this regulation. It's going to be materials that are sexual in nature, that have descriptions or depictions of sexual conduct. And then you can look to the reg to see how it defines it, to the statute, I meant to say. You can look to the statute, pre-existing South Carolina Code section. Here's where it gets, if you're a con law nerd, like probably most or all of us are, here's where it becomes sort of an interesting question, right? Anytime any matter of statutory or regulatory drafting is at some point going to involve line drawing, right? It becomes a line drawing exercise. And the goal, at least in this context, from the State Board of Education, and the goal, hopefully, in most statutory and regulatory contexts, is to draw a clear line, right? We don't want laws that are void for vagueness. We want laws that are clear, can be easily understood, that can be implemented by the folks who have to implement that at the district level and ultimately at the State Board of Education level. And so the question is, how can we clearly draw that line, and then what falls inside the line and outside the line? I'll give you a couple examples that have came up during the public hearings on the law, or that have been discussed sort of in the popular press. Right, one of the first ones you always hear challenged is the Bible. People say, oh, well, you pass this regulation, then the Bible is going to be gotten out of public schools, because that's sort of an emotion-stirring topic, at least in the South and probably elsewhere. I don't think so. Like, I just don't see it, right? Because what you'll see in the Bible, and listen, I grew up reading the King James Version, which is a bit antiquated nowadays, but right, you will see that Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore a son. You'll see that two people came together and conceived a child. Those are acknowledgments that sexual conduct exists, that it has in those instances occurred. But I don't think any plain meaning reading of the text would say that that is a description, at least not as it's defined in the code, a description, much less a depiction of sexual conduct. So I don't think we get there with that. You'll hear some reference to one of the talking points that came up repeatedly is that this regulation is going to get rid of most of Shakespeare's canon. Romeo and Juliet, gone. Well, it's been a few years, probably since my college literature class, that I've read Romeo and Juliet, but I don't recall that it had any descriptions. And again, there's no drawings in it. It's not a graphic novel, so there's no depiction. I don't think it had descriptions of sexual conduct. Here, I think, can be maybe a helpful analogy, and then I'll shut up so we can actually get some questions. And Eugene, I can tell you've got some questions. I can see them. I can see them formulating. But think of it this way. This is an example I gave in one of the hearings that seemed to be helpful to some of the objectors to the regulation. Imagine in a different context. Imagine that you were you needed a commercial building built. And so you put out a request for proposal or request for bids. And in the statement of work, it says the building needs to be ADA compliant, including an elevator if necessary. Right? That leaves some discretion to the contractor to figure out how to implement that. The contractor, you award a contract, the contractor builds a building, they include an elevator, but they do it in such a way that it's actually quite inconvenient. They put it on the back of the building, and it only goes up to the second floor and not to the mezzanine level, which is really inconvenient. And so you, the new owner of this building with a less than perfectly useful elevator, are upset with your contractor, and you want some sort of refund on it, or you're saying that's a partial breach. And you're going to get into a contract dispute there about whether or not the contractor complied. And you're going to say, the contractor can say, all you said is it needs to have one if necessary. You didn't describe where it should be, what it should do, how many pounds, how many people. You just said including an elevator if necessary. The point being, there's a difference, I think, in other contexts that we can see almost self-evidently that there's a difference between acknowledging the existence of a thing and describing a thing. Romeo and Juliet, sure, it's a tale of young love. And I'm sure that you could look at it and an adult could read that. And again, it's been a long time since I've read it, but I'm assuming for the sake of argument that there are references in there that could acknowledge the existence of the consummation of love without describing it. And I think that's the point of the analogy. Maybe it's helpful and maybe it's not. But the point being that there's I think a legally significant difference between acknowledging that something exists and describing it. I could give you other examples of it, but it's already 2:46.
I'm sorry. I'm wondering if I could just interrupt a bit just because my time is short. I wanted to ask you, so sexual conduct in the regulation is sexual conduct is defined in the obscenity statute. And I'm looking at the definition now, and it covers various things. It covers intercourse between animals, just animals having sex with each other. It includes excretory functions. It includes lewd exhibition of genitals or nipples. It includes touching of female nipples. So I'm wondering, first, what about a biology book that talks about either how animals have sex, among other things, some animals have sex somewhat differently from the way we do, and may describe that, maybe even depict it, but at least describe it, may also describe excretion. You'd think excretion is a pretty important function. So you'd think anatomy books and such would talk about that. Of course, there also may be books that describe sex just in the context of, again, biology, medicine, and such. So that's one question. You might say, well, the excretion is just sort of this weird artifact of the way it's done. Maybe it's sort of a friendly amendment to omit, let's say, sex between animals. Again, if it's a description of sex between animals, probably not going to be terribly kinky. But still, I was wondering what you thought about that. But also, speaking of the Bible, so I look up, there are these lists of relatively explicit discussions in the Bible. Apparently in Ezekiel chapter 23:18-21, they talk about someone carrying on her whoring so openly and flaunting her nakedness. And then talking about how someone longed for the lewdness of his or her, I guess her youth, when the Egyptians handled your bosom and pressed your young breasts. Now, it's true that it doesn't talk about nipples, but it seems that probably when it pretty implicitly talks about nipples, that is not just an abstract thing. And then they had sex. That does sound like a description, not of sex, to be sure, but description of two things that would qualify as sexual conduct under the South Carolina statute and therefore under this regulation: lewd exhibition of one's body and caressing or touching of female nipples. So it seems to me that under that this passage would be covered, and therefore the whole book that contains the passage, which is to say the Bible, would be covered as well. Am I mistaken on that?
You are, and I can explain why.
Tell me how that is not a description of lewd exhibition of genitals or breasts, and how that is not a description of the touching of female nipples.
Sure. Let me take both. There are two questions in there. Let me take them both in order. So the first had to do with, you mentioned sex between animals, excretory functions, and that those could come up in legitimate medical, scientific, or biological context. I didn't say this earlier for the sake of time, but if you read further on through the regulation, there's sort of a preemption and preservation clauses that includes both, Kayla, to your point, it doesn't interfere with the ability of parents to opt out, right? So it doesn't affect opt-outs. It doesn't interfere with, and this is, Eugene, to your point more specifically, any material or instruction that is required or permitted by South Carolina's comprehensive health education law. And that law, again, you have to go and look at it. That law is broadly written enough to both allow and require for the type of things you were talking about in the first part of your question, not the Bible.
Well, but that would be about health ed for children with regard to human sexuality. So I appreciate that. I stand corrected on that. But if it's just in a biology or an anatomy book that discusses, not as a matter of health education, but just as a matter of understanding the way animal processes work, either animal sex or excretion, wouldn't that not be saved by that exception?
If it's in a biology textbook, and we can use that term maybe a little bit more broadly than literally the ninth mm-hmm. grade text used in biology class, that's going to fall within either the comprehensive health education law, which, as mm-hmm. you mentioned a second ago, is broader than just sex ed. Mm-hmm. It includes okay. sex ed. There's a couple other carve outs in there as well related to other specific pre-existing statutory requirements or allowances. So that one I don't think is as difficult or as troubling, though in fairness to you, I hadn't gotten to that. I didn't describe that section of the law. I think the more interesting question is not why are there compilations on the internet of the erotic passages of scripture, but what do we do with them? The ones you brought up, I think are interesting in particular, and I'll apologize, I'm not looking at them right now. But I'm going to just draw on sort of my general recollection of those passages of scripture. The second one, at least, I'm quite confident, is metaphorical in nature. It's using an analogy to refer to Israel and its time in Egypt. And this is a fairly common metaphor in scripture to refer to the nation of Israel or in the New Testament, the Christian church, as a bride, as a woman, all throughout the prophetic books of the Bible. I shouldn't say all throughout, frequently, often. Throughout the prophetic books of the Bible, the writers will use the analogy of Israel as, in some instances, and I think this may even be from Ezekiel, an outcast child left abandoned on the field, who I brought in, and this is God metaphorically speaking, that I brought in, I clothed, I fed, I raised up, I protected, and when you became of age, I was betrothed to you, but you turned against me. And this, to your example, went, in the words of some of the older translations, went whoring and displayed your nakedness. Now, again, those are not specific historic narrative descriptions of a person engaging in those events. They're poetic or metaphorical descriptions, I suppose, of, in the scriptural context, of the Almighty's view of his chosen nations turning against him, rejecting him, and chasing after other false gods, false idols, etc. So I don't know that, and I suppose I should try to stay in my lane too. I'm not an ancient Hebrew scholar, though I've read these passages. That's my understanding, and I suppose I could defer to a seminarian who may have a more nuanced understanding of them. But I think that's the answer to those.
Got it. So we have a lot of questions. So let me start with one from Margot Cleveland, who's asking whether libraries should be properly seen as limited public fora for private speech, rather than places of government speech. And by the way, an interesting question is how this all plays out with regard to public libraries. Is the analysis different for the two? That is to say, public non-school libraries. But we do know there are some situations where the government operates property, provides space on that property, provides even funding for that. And it can discriminate based on viewpoint. It can discriminate based on content. So some of these regulations may be permissible on those grounds, but not based on viewpoint with regard to that. So that's the question. Why shouldn't it be treated more as a place for which is a limited public forum for private speech, that is to say, speech of the authors of the books, and thus subject to viewpoint neutrality rule, and not government speech?
Yes, I think that's a really good question. And I'll say I really appreciate and love when people come with like meaningful, substantive questions that we can grapple with. And so, Margot, I appreciate it very much. Here, I think, is the distinction. And I'm just going to assume that most of our listeners are familiar generally with forum analysis, traditional public fora, limited forum, and non-public fora. And Eugene, you gave a good description of that middle category there. Here, I think, is the distinction. Even in a, I'm trying to avoid using the word traditional, even in a common or sort of the exemplar limited public forum that we think of, in all of the ones I'm aware of, both from, again, having done quite a bit of work in higher education law and other contexts, in all of those, the speaker whose viewpoints are under consideration is a speaker who voluntarily and affirmatively initiated them. So they came into that space to speak. The government didn't go and get them and carry them into the space to speak. The government made available a forum into which people could voluntarily come to speak. Once that happens, then again, it could be content restricted, right? You can only talk about Clemson football here. You can't talk about other things, but you can be pro or against. We can't limit you on whether you think Clemson's good, bad, or terrible. School library context is different, right? It's not just a forum limited only to the discussion of books, but anyone can come and say whatever they want about books. No, the only way a speaker, a message gets into that is the government affirmatively goes out and picks it and buys it and reviews it and carries it in and places it in front of the students. And I think that's a material distinction between the two.
Got it. Kaylin, any thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to add a quick point. I think one of the most helpful ways to look at these questions is to flip the facts. So instead of talking about a book that, you know, would be sexually explicit or maybe pushing an LGBT ideology, let's think about a Christian book. Let's think about Pilgrim's Progress. It's one of the most widely selling books of all time. It's patterned after the Bible. It's obviously Christian. It's very evangelical in the way you read it. I'm curious whether Pilgrim's Progress is in any public school libraries. I'm confident that it's not in any public school curriculum. And if a Christian teacher tried to teach it and speak about it and lead a discussion, they would be fired. I can almost guarantee it because we represent clients all the time who were fired because their speech was viewed as government speech, even though they were speaking, you know, at a Christian club after school, or they wanted to describe the reason they wore a hijab to a coworker, and they were suddenly viewed as offensive or discriminatory, and they were fired. We represent clients from all faiths who encounter this all the time. So I think that's just a helpful way to analyze and to remember that whatever doctrines are established that keep some books out are also going to keep the religious books out. And I think the other piece of it that's really interesting is that one of the reasons why religion has been excluded from the classroom over the last 50 years is the Lemon Test. And the Lemon Test has been overruled. In Kennedy, the court made that very clear. And so now, you know, I hope that a book with some religious insight would be permitted in, you know, a curriculum or a public school library, for example, because children can be exposed to that. And certainly if young children can be exposed to sexual content and if teachers are free to talk about their private lives, even if that would be considered inappropriate by many parents, then, you know, why can't teachers talk about their faith? And just to give you an example with our clients in Minnesota, one of the principals is still pushing back on this idea of alternative learning because she doesn't want to accept it. And she has said to our clients that, well, I can't control what the teachers say, because they can say whatever they want, which is a very interesting position given speech. They can't preach their faith, so why could they share about their private life in a way that's, you know, viewed by the parents to be inappropriate?
Yeah, so there's no doubt that the rules with regard to the curriculum leave vast discretion under any view, even Board of Education versus Pico, even the four justices who would have imposed restrictions on removal of books from the a school library acknowledged that it's up to the school to decide what the curriculum is. So I think we may be out of time. So let me just ask if there are any closing words. Let me start with Kayla because Miles has had the bulk of the time so far.
Yes, thank you so much. I'll just close with this. I do think that school choice is a very significant help on these issues because, you know, we have charter schools, we have religious schools, we have homeschooling, hybrid options. Those are all wonderful. And access to vouchers, more friendly state policies, making that financially possible for families, I think is part of the answer. But I'm so glad we're grappling with issues in the public schools because a lot of families really do not have an alternative. Our clients in Minnesota, for example, there is not a Muslim school alternative that they're comfortable with. There's not a charter school that's available to them. They're not able to afford a private school or to homeschool. And so I think especially for families like them, and Justice Alito has acknowledged this in multiple different opinions, one of them in Morse v. Frederick, he says, you know, parents do not give up their constitutional rights to direct the upbringing of their children just because they go to public school. And for many parents, there's not a meaningful choice there. That's really the option they have to take. So that's why I think it's so important and valuable to grapple with these issues and to find a place where we do have pluralism. We do have multiple faiths and no faith at all that are all welcome, but there's not one ideology that's being forced onto young children in a way that goes against their parents.
Got it. Thanks very much. And Miles, any brief closing remark?
I'll just close very briefly with what I hope is a word of encouragement. And that is that throughout the past 6, 8, 9 months dealing with some of these cases, I have been generally encouraged by the fact that although we live in an increasingly polarized political age, that there are people of good faith on different sides of issues, these issues, that are willing to come forward and discuss them and debate them in a civil way. There's a lot of noise in the background, but I think there are people of good faith who are still interested in debating these ideas and talking about them and trying to find a way forward. And that's been an encouragement to me. And I hope it's one that can characterize these discussions, both in South Carolina and across the country going forward.
Great. Thank you very much, everybody. And thank you very much to the Federalist Society for organizing this.
If you don't mind, I'll hop in and second to those thanks. Appreciate you all joining us today and lending us part of your afternoons. Thank you also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, however, this webinar can wrap up and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.